You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Rich Reads, 8 New Books, From a Cartoon Collab to a Dim Sum How-To, Fulfill All Manner of Desires, by Keziah Weir. If You Ache to Connect, Memorial, by Brian Washington, published by Riverhead. In this sharp debut novel, Houston couple Mike and Benson work through family strife and a relationship reckoning. If You Miss Live Music, Nobody Ever Asked Me About the Girls, by Lisa Robinson, published by Henry Holt. The Vanity Fair contributing editor collects her conversations with women artists from Joni Mitchell to Beyoncé. If You Want to Go Deep, To Be a Man, by Nicole Krauss, published by HarperCollins. Serpentine short stories that plumb human bonds and self-exploration in settings from Tel Aviv to post-9/11 New York. If You Need a Laugh, A Wealth of Pigeons, by Steve Martin and Harry Bliss, published by Celadon, a sweetly goofy team effort by the king of slapstick and the lauded cartoonist. If Your Tastes Are Cinematic, Cherry Hill, by Jonah Frank, published by Monticelli Press. Enlisting Laura Dern to play your mother in a multimedia memoir is what one might call a mood, and executed here to brilliant effect. If Time Travel's Your Thing, Still Life by Zoe Wickham, published by the New Press. Ghost of the West Indies slave trade and a character plucked from Orlando populate this fictional search for the life details of a real poet. If You Can't Stop Cooking, The Nomois Cookbook by Wilson Tang and Joshua David Stein, published by Echo. The head of the New York City Tea Parlor serves beloved recipes and portraits of fellow Chinatown business owners. If You're Looking for Magic, Major Arcana by Francis F. Denny, published by Andrews McMeel. Collected portraits of self-identified witches in America, prompted by the photographer's own family ties to an accused 17th-century witch and a Salem judge. Thank you. Wear Your Art on Your Sleeve by Daisy Shaw Ellis, with photographs of Louis Vuitton Capuchin by Josh Smith, Jean-Michel Otunil, and Beatrice Milhaz. Big decisions about art usually revolve around where to hang it, not what to wear it with. The Art et Capuchin bag series by Louis Vuitton turns that on its head. Six contemporary artists, Beatrice Milhaz, Jean-Michel Otunil, Josh Smith, Zhao Zhao, Henry Taylor, and Liu Wei, have garnished the handbag in their signature sensibilities, from eponymous swaths of color to playful pearl-like spheres. Like a limited edition print, there are just 200 of each iteration, transforming the wearer into a gallery of one. Dancing Queen, Ariana DeBose talks the prom, Spielberg, and Broadway jitters by Britt Hinemuth, with photograph by Emma Trim. West Side Story's Anita has an impressive track record, netting Cheetah Rivera and Karen Olivo Tonys, and making Rita Moreno the first Latina to win an Oscar. Lots of people have absolutely no problem telling me that they wanted my job, says the Tony-nominated Afro-Latina actor Ariana DeBose of her coveted role in Steven Spielberg's forthcoming remake. And with her starring role in Ryan Murphy's Netflix movie musical The Prom, opposite Meryl Streep, Nicole Kidman, and Kerry Washington, she's giving us something to sing about. She entered the competitive dance world at age 3. At 18, I auditioned for So You Think You Can Dance. She was sent home. I was told that I was a stunning dancer, but didn't have enough passion in my eyes for what I do. That took me a while to get over. She was one of the 30 Broadway debuts in Lin-Manuel Miranda's Bring It On, the musical. The same choreographer booked her in Hamilton's original cast. I watched my colleagues become rock stars in front of my eyes. She had less than 12 hours' notice for the West Side Story audition. I realized very quickly that Senor Spielberg was in the room. At one point, he picked up one of his cameras, and it felt like we were doing a pas de deux, just him and me. After the dance call, DeBose, running late to her matinee of Summer, the Donna Summer musical, told Spielberg she couldn't read lines that day. Playing hard to get is inherently very Anita, she says. She was nervous to meet Moreno, now playing Valentina, in Tony Kushner's rewrite of the script. But she was so gracious with me, she redefined how the movie business looked at Latinos. When the film premieres in 2021, DeBose says, I know that it will be given to the world in the best way possible. The release will usher in a new energy for New York City. In The Prom, DeBose plays a cheerleader coming to terms with her sexuality. I'm really hoping that the mother-daughter relationship with Carrie will be something that is a great conversation starter for young, queer, beautiful girls of color.
Thank you.
Full court. Royal fashion is singular in its purpose and its power, writes Elizabeth Holmes in her new book, HRH, So Many Thoughts on Royal Style. The clothes carefully orchestrated for a family that's seen more than heard. Here, Holmes gives tips from Windsor Wardrobes for an expertly outfitted month. Crowded room. Invoke the Queen for your next video conference. Whether it's for business or pleasure, a bold, bright hue will ensure your box jumps out of the grid. Virtual Thanksgiving. Assert your place in the family, or deflect questions about when the engagement's happening, in a striking look and a standout neckline accessory. Voting Day. Channel Lady Literal in a flag-inspired ensemble, starting with a Kate-approved classic stripe. A block heel will keep you standing tall while standing in line. Outdoor dining. Why wear a coat when you can wear a cape? Meghan's early signature is chic, practical, and cozy enough for chillier alfresco nights. Daughters of the American Revolution. Tiffany Trump, as she made clear in her Republican National Convention speech, has drunk her dad's Kool-Aid. Other GOP daughters? Not so much. Here, a spectrum of filial piety. Outspoken liberals, party-line conservatives, and everyone in between. Now, here are the daughters. Claudia Conway, age 15, claim to fame, viral TikTok account, occupation, high school student, expression of rebellion, pushing for emancipation, energy, chaotic good, likely inheritance, couples therapy, fictional avatar, Carrie White. Noteworthy quote, there is no one who hates at real Donald Trump more than me. Begotten by Kellyanne Conway. Jess Bond, age 38, claim to fame, leaked text, occupation, filmmaker, expression of rebellion, renouncing the family name, energy, chaotic neutral, likely inheritance, Ukrainian blood money, fictional avatar, Carmen Sandiego. Noteworthy quote, Dad and Trump are literally living in the same building, and Mom says they go up and down all day long hanging and plotting together. Begotten by Paul Manafort. Caroline Giuliani, age 31. Claim to fame, Kamala Harris fangirl. Occupation, director, actor, writer, and weirdo. Expression of rebellion, voting for Obama. Energy, lawful good. Likely inheritance, dentures. Fictional avatar, Luna Lovegood. Noteworthy quote, back-to-back Kamala pics, hashtag sorry, not so sorry. Begotten by Rudy Giuliani. The Bush twins, age 38. Claim to fame, first twins. Occupation, co-host of Today with Hoda and Jenna, co-founder of Global Health Corps. Expression of rebellion, registering as independents. Energy, neutral good. Likely inheritance, portrait of Barney, the Scottish Terrier. Fictional avatar, Jessica and Elizabeth Wakefield. Noteworthy, quote, this moment feels a little frightening because I'm nervous to have the TV on to hear some of the rhetoric that is coming from the highest position, said Jenna Bush Hager. Begotten by George W. Bush. Audrey Pence, age 26, claim to fame, not Charlotte. Occupation, fiancé, Yale law grad. Expression of rebellion, attending Yale law. Energy, lawful evil. Likely inheritance, chastity belt. Fictional avatar, Tracy Flick. Noteworthy quote, the person I get the most respect from is my dad. He tells me so many times, I am proud of you for having your own opinions and looking into things. Begotten by Mike Pence. Tiffany Trump, age 27, claim to fame, self-appointed rich kid of Instagram. Occupation, job-seeking Georgetown law grad. Expression of rebellion, wearing a blue pantsuit at the RNC. Energy, chaotic evil. Likely inheritance, crippling debt. Fictional avatar, Karen Smith. Noteworthy quote, I don't know what it's like to have a typical father figure. Begotten by Donald Trump. Attention shoppers, the hottest place to see and be seen in Hollywood, a grocery store. Inside the Cult of Erewhon, by Michelle Ruiz, with opening photo of the store by Michelle Grosskopf. Cara Delevingne, Ashley Benson, and a rubber-gloved Kaia Gerber were spotted on a friend date there in March. In April, Jake Gyllenhaal and Demi Lovato each popped in wearing masks, followed by Hilary Duff in May and Miley Cyrus in June. After reportedly splitting from Delevingne, Benson returned in July with rapper Jeezy. In August, A$AP Rocky scanned the snackage. Stefan Voice, the hottest pandemic club in Los Angeles, is Air One. The all-organic, frequently macrobiotic VIP room of grocery stores where vegan coconut yogurt cost $19. And there's a naturopathic doctor on staff to recommend calming reishi mushrooms. According to Air One Twitter, Steven Tyler once whispered "you're beautiful" to a female shopper, and Ellen may or may not have reamed out the hot bar staff for running out of scrambled eggs. Under a statewide stay-at-home order that shuttered Hollywood amid an attention apocalypse in which there was nowhere to go and, worse, nowhere to be seen, stars still flocked to Erewhon. Pronounced Erewhon, but in certain surfer dude lilts is reduced to two syllables, Erewhon. The prepared buffalo cauliflower is a near erotic experience for many, but the real draw of Erewhon is that it's a scene, chef and fresh-off-the-boat author Eddie Huang emailed from Taipei. You bump into everyone you matched on Raya or once met at Benny Blanco's house. Unsure of where they'd snap celebrities in a dystopian Hollywood, paparazzi set up among the shopping carts in parking lots across Erewhon's six-store mini-empire, including Fairfax, Venice, and the Kardashian-settled Calabasas. You used to get celebrities there on occasion, pre-pandemic, said Grant Hodgson, news editor at photo agency Backgrid. Leonardo DiCaprio and Dakota Johnson are regulars. Kanye West famously tweeted about the Erewhon drip, a trying, not trying outfit of fleece, sweats, and one athletic sandal. But post-pandemic, it's become an absolute staple. It's more popular than ever. For shoppers of the Who Weekly set, your Brody Jenners and Tommy Dorfmans, an Erewhon jaunt under quarantine offers both CBD lemonade and a stab at relevance. It says, "I'm going to the grocery store," says Chris Black, co-founder of brand consultancy Public Announcement, and a self-aware Erewhon shopper. Even though it's a grocery store where everything is very expensive, and it's completely out of reach of most Americans. Full carts are a status symbol that Black estimates can cost $1,000 if you're not buying vitamins, another pandemic inequity, considering L.A. County is the most food insecure in the nation. When COVID-19 hit, Erewhon doubled down on its trademark California chill, creating a safe haven for privileged clientele. "We have such a warrior spirit," said Jason Widner, Erewhon Vice President of Store Development and a former actor who played a young Josiah Bartlett on The West Wing. The Goop-endorsed tonic bar crafted a blood-red, immunity-boosting, lung-fortifying tonic full of amazing adaptogenic ingredients such as chaga, astragalus, cordyceps, and platycodon. Erewhon opened early for the elderly and gave them free chlorophyll water. A few next-door complaints reported Erewhon shoppers failed to social distance, but those who balked at the store's mask order weren't turned away. "If you can't put your mask on, listen, give me your credit card. Give me a list," Widener said he told people at the door. "I will go shop for you personally right now." Director Sebastian Siegel, an Erewhon devotee, declined to stock up on groceries. He only wanted to spend more time at Erewhon during the pandemic. "I'm very comfortable with whatever the world has to serve up," Siegel says, "as long as it's not buffalo cauliflower, which he doesn't eat because starch." Erewhon considers itself much more than a grocer. It's a community of like-minded people, bonded by a love of locally plucked figs. Its name is an anagram of nowhere, an homage to Samuel Butler's 1872 novel about what appears to be a utopian society. Others have noted that Erewhon is also the name of the prison in the 1997 cult classic Face Off. "You don't even have to talk to each other," said Licia Dalimore, Erewhon's vice president of brand. "The eye contact that you make waiting for your tonic bar beverage is this comforting moment like, we'll get through this together." In the next photos, Cara Delevingne and Kaya Gerber. Jake Gyllenhaal. When the original Erewhon opened its doors in Boston in 1966, there weren't enough grains to stock the shelves, just a modest supply of whole wheat in an old-fashioned general store. Natural foods bubbled up as options in the 1940s in response to DDT and chemical farming, but health nuttery remained on the fringe while TV dinners took off. Erewhon's married co-founders were the late Michio and Aveline Kushi. Michio, who came to America from Japan in 1949 as a political science student, adopted the ethos that natural foods could be a gateway to world peace. Healthy people create healthy, peaceful families, communities, society, and eventually the world, is how macrobiotic counselor Denny Waxman, who trained with the Cushies at the original Erewhon, describes the philosophy. It was a biological revolution. Erewhon became a hangout, with people piling into vans and driving hundreds of miles to visit. According to Waxman, Aveline was the dynamo behind Erewhon's expansion to Los Angeles in 1969, 11 years before Whole Foods' founding. Whole Foods did a great job up until about 10 years ago, Widener said, when it changed its produce from organic to an organic plus conventional mix, then got Amazoned. Meanwhile, Kraft had given way to Annie's, and organic food became the $50 billion business Erewhon had planted the seeds for. 2 decades ago, Erewhon was still a single, funky, old-school health food store, where Moon Juice founder Amanda Chantal Bacon met store legend Truth Calkins manning an outpost of L.A. herbal bar Dragon Herbs inside Erewhon. "Calkins was my favorite bartender," Chantal Bacon says, "delivering custom elixirs for immunity, exhaustion, or her cycle. I don't drink, so this really was like my version of going to a bar." Widener quips, "I always say, get high off the good stuff." So began Erewhon's metamorphosis from groovy grocer to social club. Widener remembers James Gandolfini circling the tonic bar before his death in 2013. "I was like, dude, stop staring at the menu. Come here and let me help you," he says. Jennifer Garner's Once Upon a Farm baby food landed on shelves in 2016, and a pregnant Kim Kardashian came in. Widener grew very close with other celebrities he wishes he could name. "I can call Owen Wilson anytime I want. People like that." The rise of Instagram, coupled with the nebulous notion of wellness, helped make Erewhon the new Ivy. A stories-worthy scene where influencers in mauve leggings pop their heels before the rainbow wall of juices. It attracts guys who drive G-wagons and girls who are sporty and rich and like Yeezys, Black says. Those people, 5 to 10 years ago, would have been in a club, doing coke, partying, drinking. Now, being healthy is cool. Having a $30 lunch at a grocery store is cool. Under new owner Tony Antocci, Erewhon has gone wide, expanding from one store to six, following the luxury high-rises into newly gentrified neighborhoods. On season two of You, Penn Badgley's pathological Joe works at Enervin, an anagram of Nirvana, an obvious Erewhon stand-in. The chain inspires love and mockery in equal measure. Erewhon serves a function for really rich, lazy people who want to shop for produce and perhaps cross paths with someone they forgot to have sex with, Huang says. Widner claims to love my question about Erewhon's high prices, maintaining that practically every product in the store has a detailed Portlandia sketch-worthy backstory. The Pachamama Farm sausage from Oregon is the best sausage in the world, he said. They're wild foresting animals. But Erewhon downplays that it's a capitalist enterprise. Profit is the side effect of our real purpose, Antochi declares on the website. Erewhon could soon bring its characteristically California business back to the East Coast. Ever since New York private equity firm Stripes assumed an ownership stake in 2019, a New York outpost has been buzzed about. Erewhon can become a national brand, Stripes founder Ken Fox told Forbes last year. Can it? Luxe grocers like Citarella and Dean and DeLuca, rest in peace, have long been the provenance of Upper East Side doyens, while the influencer set flits to Chacha Macha. People are wearing full-on outfits when it's 100 degrees to go get some kale. Black laughed of the paparazzi-documented Erewhon outing. It's a scene that can only exist in L.A.
Thank you.
darkness visible. What might have been written off as Trumpist madness, the conspiracy of QAnon, is seeping into every corner of America's mind. And the Danger is Real, by Jeff Charlotte, with photographs by Gregory Halpern. She saw shadows. She always had. She was spiritual. Not Christian. She'd left that behind when she'd left Waco in her early 20s. She got into Wicca, super witchy, says a friend. She was fun, happy, a little wild. Just a normal girl. I call her Evelyn, because she's in a sense a hostage now, a captive of her beliefs. There are Evelyns everywhere. This Evelyn was in Austin. She worked when she could. Sometimes she danced, stripped. She had a boyfriend who took care of her. She'd never had much luck holding on to a job. She'd bounce back and forth between her family in Waco and her friends in the city, right to left, red to blue. She was bright. A good listener, says one friend, a liberal lawyer whom Evelyn called freedom fighter. She was gullible, says another friend, the one who introduced Evelyn to QAnon not long into the pandemic for shits and giggles. Which is how Evelyn came to believe that the shadows she'd seen within Wicca as the nuances of life were actually the satanic forces that Q. Thought by devotees to be a government insider dropping cryptic clues via chat forums about Trump's decades-old plan to destroy the deep state. Believes control the Democratic Party. She followed the white rabbit, as QAnon believers put it. She went down the rabbit hole. She came to believe that the darkness to which she'd always been sensitive was not part of the light, but at war with it. That the shadows had become flesh, and that the flesh had become politics, and that the love of Trump she'd embraced because she loved her family, abandoning her once liberal views, required the hatred of his enemies, the cabal. Child sacrificing Democratic elites, a monstrous network, not just of pedophiles, but of cannibals, harvesters of children's adrenal glands, all the better to stay youthful, for an evil concoction, one part Botox and two parts blood libel. The old idea that Jews make matzo from the blood of Christian babies. Do I need to say none of this is true? I do, but the delusion is every bit as dangerous as if it were. On the morning of August 12th, Evelyn decided it was time to save the children, as the hashtag that's been co-opted by Q puts it. She got into her ancient little red two-door Pontiac Fiero. She'd been drinking. She'd later test at twice the limit. But that didn't slow her down. She'd been awake for days, researching. That's what QAnon followers call their hours committed to YouTube videos and podcast and deep study. The algorithms fed her. She fed the algorithms, making memes for Twitter and Instagram. She texted her findings to her friends. One tried to warn her. You're being used. I'm seeing things, she answered. 3 a.m., 4 a.m., 5 a.m., says the friend, who now regrets introducing Evelyn to QAnon. Evelyn didn't realize her friend thought it was funny. Her friend didn't know Evelyn was taking it so seriously. 100%, says the friend now, like the Bible, like it was gold. When she realized what was happening, the friend tried to talk Evelyn down. Go to sleep, she begged. I can't, Evelyn said. I'm not sleeping till Trump does. Like Q, she believed her president is working tirelessly to prepare for the storm, the salvation of democracy, by executing the Kabbalist, the Kabbalist, all of them. At 9:22 that morning, Evelyn found one. It was obvious. The Kabbalist was driving a white van, the kind used by kidnappers in movies. Also the kind used by caterers in real life. The caterer had her young daughter with her. Evelyn jumped out at a light and began screaming. The caterer hit the gas. Evelyn got back in her Fiero and returned to the prowl. Soon she saw another shadow, a young Latinx woman driving a Dodge Caravan. Evelyn veered into the middle turning lane so she could try to force the caravan over. The driver, a 19-year-old on her way to register for classes at community college, tried to turn into a police station. Evelyn rammed the caravan. The student saw a cop in a parking lot. She squealed in, honking. "She kept ramming into me," says the student. 8 times, she thinks. Maybe more. Half my body went numb. Had Evelyn not crashed into a concrete pylon, she might have committed murder. And if she'd done that, she might be as infamous as Kyle Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old Kenosha killer whose original defense attorney declared Rittenhouse had fired the first shot of the second American Revolution. Instead, Evelyn is just a woman who went too far. Or, from the point of view of QAnon, not far enough. That she might have spiraled into some different sort of chaos had Trump and Q not been there to feed her delusions shouldn't make us feel safe, because Trump is there, and he sees shadows too. There are no turning points when the world is spinning out of control. So the Trump interview with Fox News' Laura Ingraham that aired August 31st, displaced by the time you read this by a dozen more distractions and disasters, did not so much mark a new low as erase altogether the meaning of pre-Trump terms such as new low. Now there's only the abyss. We're all in it together, and Trump is down here too. Which is why it's worth pausing as we rush toward November and the certain violence that will follow any outcome to consider Trump's words to Ingraham. "Biden," he says, slumped in a chair. "Biden is, I don't even like to mention Biden." Fact check, he does. "Because he's not controlling anything. This is Trump boilerplate. He's been calling Biden a puppet since at least last fall." Ingraham attempts to normalize. The media of which Trump approves doesn't just parrot his words. It launders them. Ingraham asks, who's pulling the strings? She proposes Obama's people, which is triple ply. Simultaneously, a plausible suggestion of continuity, a racist dog whistle, and a bone for QAnon, followers of which know that Obama's people means pedophiliac cannibals. It's the kind of yes and message that'd usually elicit a smirk from Trump, an insult comic at heart. Not this time. He tilts forward, his hands uncharacteristically clasped between his knees, and breaks eye contact, glancing away. His voice gathers texture. "People that you've never heard of, people that in the dark shadows, people..." "Dark shadows," says Ingraham. "What is that?" "It's not a question, it's a redirect." "No," Trump says, as if he knows how he sounds. "People that you haven't heard of," he repeats. In the past, when Trump spoke of Biden's puppeteers, he wanted you to think you knew whom he meant. Reasonable Republicans understood it was Pelosi and Schumer. Just as many Democrats say McConnell controls Trump. Racist heard him calling out AOC and the Squad, impertinent women of color, and the deeper read was George Soros, maybe the Rothschilds. But something different is happening with Ingraham. He's not insinuating that she knows who he's talking about. He's insisting she doesn't. It's none of the usual suspects. Nobody and everybody. Nameless and everywhere. When he glances away, it's as if only he can see them. An intimate moment, not between Trump and Ingraham, but between Trump and his own mind. We're witnessing a man cross a line, not one of transgression. To him, such borders mean nothing, but of belief. "There are people that are on the streets," he says. "There are people that are controlling the streets. The invisible enemy he's spoken of before, the one QAnon calls Clinton or Comey or Podesta. But this foe has no name. He speaks of an airplane in a certain city, one full of thugs in dark uniforms, indistinguishable like a virus. This happened, he says, then they're on a plane, present tense. This is all happening right now. It has the dream logic of a nursery rhyme. On the streets, in the air, dark shadows, everywhere. What Trump is describing is no more nor less exotic than the popular evangelical concept of spiritual war, the conflict thought to be raging always around us and within, between believers and principalities and powers, according to Ephesians, or demons in the contemporary vernacular. QAnon has translated the concept from King James into Trumpish, but Trump is no more reading Q drops than undead John JFK Jr. is writing them. For once, there's nothing contrived about Trump's answer. He's not saying what he thinks MAGA wants to hear. Dark shadows is, in fact, the wrong answer, as Ingram tries to signal. But he can't hear her. Trump used to flirt with and feed morsels to evangelicalism's spiritual warriors and the rabbit holers of Q. That's when they were distinct constituencies, the Christians and the crazies. Lately, they've been merging. The theology of Q infecting evangelicalism, the organization of the Christian right incarnating Q's digital power. Together, they're his base, his hope, and now, maybe, his identity. He's no longer a con artist. Now he's his own mark, like an email scammer who clicks on his own malware. He isn't selling a dream. He's dreaming it. The difference between him and his believers is that he has the power to make the dream real, for them, for him, for us. To summon into being the American carnage he nightmared at his inauguration, the cities, he said, were desolate, now set ablaze, the killers in the street recast as heroes with paramilitary backup, fear a daily given, the plague risen up from legend to fill the land with ghosts. This was his dream. Now we are all nightmaring it together. When Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany was asked to explain Trump's defense of QAnon, she insisted neither she nor the president knew a thing about it. But at the close of the interview, apropos of nothing, she said, "There's a lot of children in this country who have died on the streets of Democrat cities. We're focusing on capturing criminals." What was she talking about? Maybe she meant gun violence in Chicago, a favorite Trump topic, or the blonde girls he describes falling prey to human animals. But I heard Q. I heard save the children. Was she signaling, I wondered? A very Q question. I thought of a Q podcast, Praying Medic, to which I'd started listening. This information is real. Distractions are necessary, says the medic, explaining the need for Q's cryptic constructions. So real, it demands the poetry of myth, not the dull prose of politics. Double meanings like loop the loops, Kairos, sacred time, disguised as Kronos, TikTok, as QAnon says. Consider the 3rd of November, a date seemingly promised by Q in October 2017 to deliver indictments against the cabal, around which public riots, versus the private kind, would be organized in an attempt to prevent their arrest. November 3rd, 2017 came and went sans perp walk or broken windows. But who knows which November 3rd Q meant? Ask the medic. I see the answer before he says it. There are riots now, and November is coming. Tick-tock. I thought of Rittenhouse's first shot, and his lawyer's second American Revolution, and the plastic bag his supporters claimed was a Molotov cocktail, and of Michael Rennell, the Portland protester who said his kill shot felt like the beginning of a war. I thought of retribution, Trump's term for the police killing of Rennell. That's the way it has to be, he explained. Tit-tat, tick-tock. I thought of Michael R. Caputo, the Trump aide, who on Facebook warned of Bidnot hit squads and called for supporters to stock ammunition, and also spoke of shadows. Shadows on the ceiling in my apartment. There, alone, shadows are so long. I shook it off. Insane. But what about McEnany? This article will be continued in the next installment, alas, after the election. Gregory Halpern's photos for this article show a hand tattooed with stars and a sky with an orange full moon. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available at our website as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.